Before we get started, I want to make sure that I give a big shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie Colwin is a stress and mind-body coach based out of Los Angeles, and you might remember that she actually guest-hosted the podcast back in January and came on live with me back in August of 2021. And it sounds like we might do another in-person at some point this summer, so we'll see. TBD. Jeannie facilitates breath work to decrease stress, release stuck negative emotions, and decrease pain. Are you having trouble calming the monkey mind? Well, she knows all about that. You see, it's not about controlling or managing your stress or your thoughts. Instead, it's about shifting and improving the relationship that you have with them. You see, Jeannie spent 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and a myriad of other chronic symptoms that left her physically and mentally exhausted. She healed herself completely and is obsessed with getting her clients fast results through her one-on-one coaching program. Have you experienced a live, full-length breathwork class with Jeannie and her incredible community yet? Well, she's offering her next online breathwork class for free just for the mind and fitness community with a special new theme of confidence and worthiness. The link to register to her next class on Sunday, June 26th is in the show notes. Just use the promo code mind and fitness, all one word, to register for free. Register even if you cannot attend live because the replay will be sent out afterwards. So I know the one thing that I always tell all my clients or all my customers in my day job is that on demand has so much more power if you're somebody that can't attend. So if the option is either attending live or not attending at all, if you have an option of on demand, take it because you can do it at your leisure. Thanks so much, Jeannie. Let's get to the show. Thanks for coming back. It's June the 9th, Thursday, June the 9th. Before we get started, I wanted to make sure that I give a shout out to the patrons of the podcast. If you're interested in supporting the show monetarily, go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Throw a few bucks in the tip jar. Really, really helps keeping the show on and available for everybody. So let me give a shout out to Kirk, Patricia, Emily, Brent, Paul, Amanda, Elise, Enda, Dominic, Sasha, Sylvie, James, John, Jason, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Michael, Anthony, Christina, Ross, Julie, Brian, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all so much for continuing to support the podcast every single month. It honestly means the world. So this week is another one of those instances where I was interviewed on another podcast, and that's what's going to air here. Lisa Schlossberg, who I interviewed not all that long ago, has this great podcast called Out of the Cave, and I encourage you to go and take a listen. But this is a little bit different because it's not entirely about it's not just any chronic pain story, because a big element of this revolves around issues with food, relationships with food, relationships with weight, self-esteem, things like that. Things that I haven't really even talked about on this podcast. And as long as I've been doing this, it's interesting that that's not something that has ever been discussed. So that's really what today's is going to be about. If you didn't listen several weeks ago, this is a great time to check it out and kind of hear Lisa's interview style. I think she does a great job. I felt like I was talking to a friend, which is always really the sign of a great interview. So without further ado, here is Lisa and I.
Okay. Hello. Eddie Lindenstein has made it to the pod. How are you?
We'll say Lindenstein.
Lindenstein. Eddie Lindenstein. Yeah. You know, that's funny because my mom is Goldstein. So I'm like conditioned for the Steins to be Steins.
It's a good excuse. If it is real, I don't know if that's real or not. You could be lying. But if it is not real, that's a great excuse.
I promise you it's real, but I appreciate that. Thank you for correcting me. But you've made it here. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. So, Eddie, one of the things that I just shared with you, but I love that, you know, when I was on your podcast and you said to me right before we hit record, we're just kind of like two friends hanging out at a bar having a conversation. Yep. And that's very much, you know, what we're here to do. But I'm very curious to just like get into your story and share you with the community. So having said that, thank you for being here. And can you just, you know, introduce yourself? Who are you to the people who have never heard of you before?
Yeah. So I do a podcast on, we'll say it's TMS, chronic pain, Dr. Sarno, neuroplasticity. It depends on how far out in the onion you want to go, but right. that's sort of the crux of it. I've been doing that for almost 5 years. And I'd say at this point in time, there's probably the last report that I had run was a couple of years ago, and there was about 110 different countries represented that were listening every week, amazing. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, but it's been humming along. I mean, basically there's been a couple of instances where I've taken a week off or something, but there's 222 episodes. So lots of archives. I actually had a guy email me this morning that said that the way that his podcast player works, and I think this is Apple that does this, but he was listening to this week's episode. But then when you finish, it goes to whatever the last episode that you were listening to in that feed, but didn't finish. Uh-huh. So his, the next one that played. So he's listening to 222 this morning, and then it finished and it went to the last 6 minutes of episode 48. Wow. Where I was interviewing a woman who owns several yoga studios in our area. And she was actually talking about the exact topic that this entire week's podcast was about. And I can't recall now, to be fair, I don't remember her and I talking about it either, but I don't recall any other episode where that topic mm-hmm. came up other than those two. So, you know, it's one cool. of those meant to be world things.
Yeah.
That's what I do. It's called the Mind and Fitness Podcast. And I've had some of the top therapists on earth, some of the top coaches in the space on earth, some of the most amazing case studies or testimonials from people that have overcome really, I mean, a lot of misery of pain and issues to now be living full lives. And so it's cool to get those stories.
Yeah, love it. Okay. Thank you for sharing all that. Yeah. So I'm actually curious, before we get into even more of you and your story, how much would you say, if you could divide it, how much of the stories are really chronic pain TMS related? And then how much of it is fitness kind of food body stuff? I know they're obviously, you know, yeah. so connected, and that'll be most of the conversation, I think, but
yeah. So,
I'm curious. Yeah.
So, like I said, there's 222 episodes now. For the first 13 episodes, it was called Eddie Knows Fitness. That was the title of the show. And the first episode, the whole idea was that this was going to be about sort of the conduit of a weight loss story that I had in my late teens and then again in my 20s. That was going to be the idea. And then how can I intersect this? I don't like the word transformation. I think it's used too much, but we'll say transformation of yeah. My own like chronic health issues. How can I intersect the two? That was the design of the show right. initially. And so the first person I had on was a competitive CrossFit athlete. And it was a fine interview for people that are into CrossFit, but it wasn't the kind of storytelling that I really wanted. And I did a couple of, I had a bodybuilder on. She talked about image issues and just how basically like how getting into bodybuilding was psychologically one of the worst things she's ever done.
Yeah.
Did great. She placed, she looked phenomenal. She felt miserable. So those were good stories. But then as I'm watching listenership, some of the analytics behind it, it's just kind of flatlining a little bit. And then I had this guy on who nobody had heard of. And he was a Marine and a real estate agent. He's kind of, we're telling the stories. We're sitting there, we're drinking beers. We're talking to right. two people at a bar, yeah. a makeshift bar, my living room. And, he started telling this story about, having, migraines due to, he would be like having these dreams about, some guys in his unit getting blown up in their Humvees and how he's had these migraines, like PTSD and migraines and stuff ever since battle. And I got more feedback from that episode than anything fitness related I did. And so I think probably the next person I had on was probably Nicole Sachs. And then I had, you know, I started to then have more of the experts in the field.
Right.
I rounded out what I've sort of thought of as season one. Steve Ozanich was the final interview. And that was like episode 14 or so, because my second daughter was then due to be born and I wanted to take a few months off. And then I came back and season two has pretty much run ever since. Like I said, with a couple of breaks. So, yeah. Not many, I would say fewer than five have been about fitness stuff.
Right.
So even though it's called the Mind and Fitness Podcast, I think that a lot of the messages that I get from people that resonate with the name, I think that what they see is somebody who has competed in weightlifting and competed in CrossFit and then had these various health issues that took me completely out of training in the sport, and then somehow was able to get back in. And I think that a lot of the people that gravitate to that podcast on the fitness side are the people who are at part one of that. They're out of their sport now and they want to get back in.
Right. Cool. Okay. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So, okay. Having said all of that, like I said to you, I'm curious to kind of rewind. No one who's listening to this podcast has heard your story before. So I would like to, you know, through the lens of food and eating, just to start, but then obviously there's chronic pain and TMS and all that stuff that follows. But when we go back to just childhood, you know, as a kid, what do you remember about your relationship with food, eating, your body, let's say from like 0 to 10?
Yeah. So I don't have a lot from when I was that young. Some of the stuff that I do remember though, I remember my mom working out to Phil Collins and Genesis a lot, and Jane Fonda. I remember that was on in the house a lot as a little kid. And I grew up in Chico, which is a few, you know, it's like, I don't know, 8 hours north of you in San Diego. So I remember a lot of that. I remember my mom going through periods of time where she would have a lot of like portioning, like every little kid loves ice cream, and I'd have like the ice cream out, and she'd have like imagine a measuring cup that's a quarter of a cup, which is usually the measuring amount or serving size.
Yeah.
The thing of ice cream, and like she would fill it, and like, I mean, a quarter of a cup is nothing, right?
Right. So
you're like, that's all you're going to have. I remember thinking that as a little kid, like, isn't that the whole idea of becoming an adult, is that you get to do whatever you want? I can have whatever. That's kind of what I really only remember as being a kid. One interesting observation though, is that I never felt or saw myself as a overweight kid living in California. I tell my wife about this a lot because she's from the Pacific Northwest, and I don't know what it is, because I think that Southern California in particular kind of has this reputation of being very vain and kind of very, like, that's sort of the vibe from people that don't live there. But when I moved from, I moved when I was nine, when I moved from California up to Seattle, the thing that struck me the most was that suddenly people that were my age, 9 years old, talked about things like weight, and they would ask me how much I weigh as a joke, which I never experienced as a little kid in California. So that was one thing. The other thing was just how like kind of adult every kid seemed to want to be. And what I mean by that is like, it was a very stark contrast to go from, I think we moved in like August or September of 1995. So I had like been like, I was still playing with action figures, and I was watching Power Rangers, and I was watching pro wrestling, and kind of all this stuff that like kids do.
Right.
And then when I moved up here, like suddenly none of that stuff was cool. Everyone watched MTV. There were nobody played with toys, like none of that stuff. And everyone would talk about each other's physical appearances. So I didn't experience that in California, and then suddenly experienced it in this suburb of Seattle, 15 miles north of it. So that's always been it's been an interesting observation and look back for me.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. And I don't know what would have caused that or why I saw that, and maybe it was just a mixture of moving to a new place. Everything is new. And so now this really jumps out at me. Yeah. I always tell my wife, like, people didn't want to be kids here. They didn't want to just have the innocence of being a kid. So that's really kind of the big weight stuff for me, and food memories and that kind of thing really sort of took place between, I would say, 10 or 11 and 17 or so.
Yeah.
So chat, whatever we get to the next part, that's
where that is super interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I totally hear you, and it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. It's just super, super interesting.
Yeah.
So before we get to, you know, 10, 11 years old, when you move at 9 and you're starting to make these observations, do you remember what it felt like emotionally?
I kind of remember just not really like enjoying my first like little while here.
Yeah.
I remember like, when I go back to my hometown now, when I go back to Chico, it's kind of I don't know if you hear about it at all down there, but it's sort of like, there's like a lot of meth. There's like a lot of crime. There's like, it's a rough place.
Yeah.
I remember I went back there last summer. I was on a solo motorcycle trip, and I remember just thinking like, this is not like what I remembered as a little kid. I remember this like rosy place. I didn't even remember bullies like as a little kid.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I moved here, like there was the bully up the street, he like put me in headlocks and he'd like, you know, beat on me and stuff like, so like, I remember a lot of stuff like that. And I totally forgot your question. I was getting to something with substance.
The question was, how did you feel emotionally?
Yes. Yes. I felt like I just sort of lost my childhood was over. Like at nine, my childhood was over. There was no more fun. Now it was time where everybody's an adult. So like now, instead of high school beginning at 15, high school now began at nine. That was kind of how I felt.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did that feel to you?
It felt kind of crummy, to be honest. Yeah.
Felt I would imagine.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
So, okay. Then, you know, you're 9 years old. It feels really crummy because you're in a new place. Everyone's seemingly an adult or acting like one. And then what starts to happen, let's say around 10, 11, in terms of food and eating in your body, how did that play out?
Yeah. So, in Chico, California, where I was from, there's no pro sports, but the closest pro sports city is either Oakland or San Francisco. And so the San Francisco Giants were my team as a little kid, Barry Bonds. I'm like the only person in my entire state that still loves Barry Bonds. Because he's a villain. At least most people think he is. But I moved here and the Mariners, our baseball team, were in the midst of their first playoff run ever. And so everybody here was really into baseball. And so everyone around me played Little League, like every kid in school played Little League. And so that was my first exposure into like athletics and sports. But I remember I told you that when I lived in California, I didn't really see myself as overweight or anything like that.
Right.
But when I got to when I went to my first Little League practice, I remember thinking, these kids are all definitely skinnier than me. Mm-hmm. Like they all look a lot different than me. They look athletic or like, you know, they feel okay. Like I remember distinctively when the coach brought like our jerseys, like our to the practice where they all got their jerseys, and the other boys had like taken their shirts off and like put the jerseys on. And it was just no big deal.
Yeah.
But like, I was like, really like, I don't look so good enough to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do it. I put the jersey on over my shirt. So those are some of the evolution starting to happen.
Yeah.
Going in and doing that. So, as far as the food stuff goes, that's really what I recall. And the only other thing that comes to mind, and I don't even know if I would call this necessarily a food thing, but it was a reward thing, is that we didn't have Dairy Queens in Northern California. Are Dairy Queens a thing in Southern California? Do you have them? Like, is that even ring? Is that might just be the best thing.
I believe so. Okay. I don't even know.
Okay. I'd never heard of it until I came here. So like there's Burger King and there's Dairy Queen.
Right. And
subsequently, pretty much wherever you find a Burger King up here, Kitty Corner, there is a Dairy Queen, which seems it has to be intentional, but they're not owned by the same people. So I don't know. But my coach had said there was any of the fields that had fences. If you could hit the ball over the fence, I'll get you a large blizzard, which is that's the biggest ice cream thing you can get. So that became the goal for a lot of kids. So that's kind of all that. And that was sort of a harmless thing. I didn't have like a weird relationship with that. I way more wanted to just be able to jack one over the fence.
Right.
And I did. For me, it wasn't about the reward of the ice cream. It was about the reward of just like looking like, you know, Mark McGuire or Sammy Sosa or Barry Bonds or whatever. So I will say that, so Little League, I got incredibly passionate about baseball, obsessive in a way, but not in a bad way. I came home every day from school. I had a pitch back in the backyard. I would throw pitches in field and I would do this for 2-3 hours every single day, rain or shine, like whatever, you know, tidal wave, whatever. And I was way into it. And made All-Stars at 11, made All-Stars at 12, made All-Stars at 13. And then in All-Stars pitching, because back then there was, so now for pitchers in Little League, one thing that exists that's probably one of the best things they've ever done for youth sports is require pitch counts. Meaning if a Little League pitcher pitches, I don't know how many pitches it is. Let's say it's 70 pitches or 60 pitches or whatever. They have to come out of the game and they can't pitch again for it's like 5 to 7 days. At that time, I pitched and started every game and probably was throwing 75 to 85 pitches every day for days on end. And then I get like a 2 or 3 day break without a game. And then I would start again. So by the time we got to All-Stars when I was 13, and thinking back, I'm a few years ago, I bled a rotator cuff and a labrum on my left shoulder, but I'm right-handed. And just knowing how that felt in the moment, I am quite certain that I tore a rotator cuff and or a labrum in my right shoulder throwing, just knowing that kind of dead arm feeling. Cause I was in All-Stars and I was like, I had kind of changed my delivery. And one of the things that I wanted to do was really get the attention of the All-Star coach.
Yeah.
And so if I can really crush pitching, maybe he'll recruit me for next year's team.
Right.
And I, so my delivery was a little different. I was going more over the top, when I was pitching as opposed to my normal, like three quarter sidearm delivery. And, I suddenly just felt like my arm is dead. I have no velocity. Like something is really off.
Yeah.
And I remember like for the rest of the All-Star series, I had asked like, can I play first base? Can I, you know, can I just try something different? I didn't say anything about the injury, nothing like that. Went through the off season, couldn't pitch. And that was like my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah.
Didn't feel like I pitched, didn't tell my parents. And then I went into the next season and just doing the first few practices, like something is really off. And it kind of like made me fall out of love with my sport. And that was kind of like the only physicality that I did, was baseball. Like I'd quit swimming to do baseball. I quit dance. Like I did jazz dance as a little kid. Yes. So I quit all these things so I could do baseball, and then now baseball's gone. And so I can do nothing, and then rapidly put on weight after that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was because of inactivity or if it was inactivity, like there was just nothing really like fueled the fire at that point in time. So that brings us to probably 14 or 15.
Yeah. Well, okay. A couple cool. Well, I think what's interesting about hearing that is I think a lot of us, you know, the way that I say it all the time is like, we are a physical being and we're also a mental, emotional, spiritual, social being. So a lot of what you're saying about, you know, you had to give up baseball and then the weight started coming on. Well, sure. There's the physical component of like not being as active and not going to practice and not going to games and not doing all of that. And there's also the mental, emotional, spiritual, social component of giving up the thing that you love and not having that kind of fuel and, you know, fill your cup, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I think I just say that for, you know, everyone who's listening, that's like, sometimes it doesn't quote unquote matter, like which one it is, right? You're all of them and they're all valid. And that is super true.
Yeah.
So, okay. Then what starts to happen?
So the jokes of weight, this is like Tarantino-ing because I'm going back just a little bit, but so I moved there and I moved here in fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade were all pretty miserable when it came to like bullying and teasing about weight. And then when I really started to put it on between like eighth and ninth grade, that's when like beginning of ninth grade, like it was like really bad, like the calling of the fat and all this kind of stuff. And I was really, I remember, there was this boy, Ryan, who, I mean, he was like merciless, like just in the way that he would say it. And I remember I went to, and every time I ride my bike or my one wheel or ride my bike with my kids or drive past this restaurant, I remember this moment. And this was probably like 99 or 2000. So it was a long time ago, but I remember being in this restaurant. I was just like, it was like a Friday night and the whole week had been like, every time I saw Ryan, like that dude was all over me. And we went to this restaurant and I was just kind of like being a jerk to my family. And my dad like pulled me outside and he was like, what's your problem? Like, you can't be at the table and act like this. And I just like fell into his arms, like burst into tears because I started telling him about this kid named Ryan and how upset it made me and all this kind of stuff. So, it's like a core memory of my childhood, was that, so, but the catch 22 was like, okay, I'm getting more overweight and these kids are making comments. And then I sort of like coupled that along with like, we didn't have much money. So my clothes didn't look very good. So I'm like the overweight kid that doesn't have nice clothes and all this. For me, it was just, I don't know, it was pretty rough up until I was like 15. And the only real like saving grace that kind of brought me out of feeling like a fat piece of shit all the time was, I met this group of guys that we all had this commonality where we like really love pro wrestling. Mm-hmm. One of them happened to be fairly well off and his parents bought him a lot of really nice clothes like Abercrombie and all the stuff that I never ever could afford.
Right.
And he would wear something like three or four times and then he'd be like, you want this? Fuck yeah, I want this. Yeah. I don't know if I can say that, but I definitely want this. His mom would buy him something in August and then by October he wasn't into it anymore. So I would wear that stuff. And then suddenly like even though I wasn't gaining more friends, but I was sort of losing some of the ammo that some of the other kids may have had to say to me. So I started having the nicer clothes. And then I remember like back when frosted tips were really cool, I would frost my tips. And so I had, you know, I had all this, like I was kind of starting to come around, but the weight was like still there and still a problem.
Yeah.
I remember the next year, and this is kind of where this is sort of like where the metamorphosis of where health and fitness became something in my life. Mm-hmm. When I would have been 15 or 16, do we want to go right there? Or do you have anything before I?
Yeah. So the first kind of, one of the curiosities I have, because everyone has a different answer to this, is while you are mindful, let's say around 12, 13, 14, 15, as this is kind of unfolding, that you're in a bigger body compared to some of your friends or some of the people on your team.
Yeah.
Is it consciously connected to your relationship with food and eating? Like, is there an awareness that one kind of has to do with the other?
Not at all. No, yeah. No, not at that period of time. Not at all.
Right. And I could say the same. I think it's so interesting, you know, how there's no awareness as a kid that that's kind of what's going on. And also thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I mean, I got full body chills when you shared that story, because I think, you know, I can personally relate on so many levels. And I know so many people listening to this have memories like that, core memories, as you say.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. So, okay. And also just want to point out again, for everyone who's listening, the, how quote unquote normal it is to have experiences like this when you're in high school, middle school and high school. And if we just connect it really quickly to the brain science, it's like, this is why it can feel that when you have to go to high school, it feels as though high school is full of saber-toothed tigers that are just kind of coming after your safety.
Yeah.
Right. And it doesn't matter that they're not actually life-threatening. But being in that kind of social context, especially as a teenager, it is developmentally appropriate for it to feel that way. And so just kind of, you know, validating that.
Well, I think about that a lot because my oldest daughter will be 8 in 2 months. And so I started feeling those barbs at 9.
Yeah.
And she's a girl, and I know it's different I had it bad enough as a boy. And so I think about that a lot how can we, meaning my wife and I, how can we arm Zoe with, you know, whatever the right kind of resilience or whatever it is to do. Like there's a friend of mine who's she's a local nurse for the University of Washington, and her daughter, I think, is like around that age. I think she's 12 or 13. But she had come across the text messages in her daughter's phone, and they were just ruthless. These kids sending her these bullying text messages. And she was talking about it on Facebook yesterday. And I was just like, Noelle is not that much older than Zoe. Like, and that's just right around the corner. And I would like to believe that we're sort of in an era of more acceptance and such, but even if you have more you know, instead of 80 people being assholes that are little kids out of 100, maybe you have 60 now or 50, but you also have the immediacy of technology. I remember when I was in high school, when I was like 17, there was this website that I don't think I found anybody that's ever heard of it, but if you Google it, it existed and you can read about it, but it was called schoolscum.com. Mm-hmm. And it was just a message board where people could anonymously, you could filter your school and then your grade and anonymously see these messages and these posts that people would make about you. And it was always about what you looked like, what you dressed like, all that kind of stuff. Thinking like, that's like Snapchat now. Like that's what this stuff is now. I'd hear about the saber-toothed tigers, even if they're not real threats, they're still perceived threats.
Right. And as we know, that's really all that matters. Yeah. And on that note, around, you know, being a parent of a kid, I want to say, you know, because I feel like I can feel the people being like, yeah, okay, so what do we do, right? Being in that position. And I think it, to me, goes back to, you know, an important, I will paraphrase this from Gabor Mate, who talks about, it's not the event alone that is traumatic. It is being alone in the event that is traumatic. And so for anyone who is a parent, who's kind of nodding their head saying, yeah, what do we do? A lot of what you can do is be part of it, you know, just present, see, hear, validate, and love your child,
yeah,
whatever goes on at school, right? And whatever's happening with the people, because that is the kind of, that's where the repair happens. Yeah. That's where the internal intrinsic safety comes from, is being able, exactly, actually, like what you just said about kind of breaking down to your dad about it, right? Yeah. That's what you can do. Yeah. And it's really real, you know? And I think that's the important thing about this, is that it's just really real. It's just really real. And it really does have every effect on us as kids and then adults. So thank you for sharing that. I do appreciate it. Okay. So then you get to around, 15, right? Is that where we left off?
Yeah. So, this is sort of like the first memory where I recall, actually like sitting there eating something I quote shouldn't have been, and actually feeling like every bite I was taking, I'm a fat piece of shit. And I'm like sitting there, and we took this road trip. My little brother at the time was competing for a national championship in wrestling. And so we drove from Seattle to Oklahoma. And it was a 5-week road trip. It was a long road trip. Basically, as soon as school got out around mid-June, we didn't get back until July 21st, July 22nd. And the reason that that's relevant, I'll come back to it on the date, but we went on this road trip, and I remember weighing myself before, and then we went on this road trip. Every dinner, and I'm not exaggerating, this is not hyperbole. Mm-hmm. Every dinner, I ordered a bacon cheeseburger and fries, and we did a road trip. So like there was no, you're not flying and then getting to this destination. Suddenly you're driving on the road. There's not even the walking through the airports. Like there's nothing to balance this out. And like my shirts during this trip, I could feel them getting tighter and tighter and tighter. To so much, in fact, that I would put, I'd wear like tank top, like wife beaters under my shirts.
Yeah.
Just to try and hide whatever I could, button it up a little bit. And then when we got back from the trip, I had weighed myself, and it was like, I looked in the mirror and knew that it was different, but it was like, I'd gained like 40 pounds in 5 weeks or 40 pounds in 6 weeks. And I was 237 pounds, and I was just like, or 238. I think it was 238. And, I was 5'6" or 5'7". So that was like a real, and here's the thing though. We got back on July 21st, and, which was a Sunday, if I recall, maybe a Monday. But the couple of days leading up to that was sort of, okay, like, I know I don't want to look like this. I know that I don't want to feel like this. Like, I want to get to the gym. Like I see, I was like a big pro wrestling nerd, and I'm like, all these guys are like super jacked, and like, they're my heroes. And like, look at how powerful they look. And I bet like, some asshole bully walks up to them in high school, they're going to say like, fuck that guy. And they're gonna beat the shit out of him. Like that's, I think of like Thor now, like equivalent is Thor now. I remember saying like, I'd never been to the gym in my life. I'm going to start going to the gym when we get back. And I think a lot of times, and like, New Year's resolutioners and stuff, like they get a bad rap where like they sort of wait for this date to come.
Yeah.
December 10th, they tell themselves January 1st, I'm changing everything.
Right.
And they get to January 1st, and then by January, like you've seen the memes, like January 15th, they're empty again. But I'd swore to myself, like, that's not going to be me, but who knows, it could have ended up being me. So we get back on a Monday, and I was like, yeah, when I wake up tomorrow, like I'm going, like life is changing today. Everything's different today. And I like, I rode my bike the next morning, went to the rec center at our, cause I wasn't old enough to go get a gym pass.
Right.
I didn't have a job. So I needed something that like, and the city's subsidized rec center was the only place I could go. So I started going, I went 7 days. It's now called WW, but I got on Weight Watchers at the time.
Right.
And they used to have back in this day, and I don't know if you're going to remember this or anybody listening will, but they used to have this like slider thing where you would basically like you'd line up, I think it was like the protein and the fat and the calories, and then it would give you a point value.
Yeah.
And then you could look in their little cheat sheet and say, here's how much you weigh and how much you want to weigh and how much time you want to pass. And here's how many points you get in a day.
Right.
So I think the allotted points it gave me for my targets was like 19 or 20 points a day. And I had said, I'm going to stay under 13 or 14 points every day, and I'm going to work out 7 days a week for 2 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So I did that for like, I probably did that for about 4 straight months or so. And I lost about 40 pounds. So pretty much back to where I was before the trip. But I was so fried. Yeah. Like so fried.
Yeah.
No longer saw myself as overweight, even though I was now pretty much the same weight I was when I still felt I was overweight before that trip, but I did feel very empowered. Mm-hmm. And again, there is no change on the scale, but to me at the time, there was a perceived change of like, I'm exhausted, but I didn't care, or I just didn't feel like I was the same overweight guy I had been 6 months earlier.
Yeah.
So I think we had talked on the podcast that you came and did that this period of time I had gotten a job, and I was now like buying my own clothes. Like,
so are you still like, how old are you?
15 okay. At this time. Yeah.
Okay.
I had gotten a job, and 2002. No, I'd have been 16. Yeah. So I had like gotten a job. I was like buying the clothes that I wanted. I've had the empowerment feeling from going to the gym. But I had stopped going just because I was like, I was tired. I was just, you know, but the edge was off. I didn't feel this pressure anymore to lose a bunch of weight, and it was all internal pressure. So I had stopped working out entirely, and not that my diet got away from me, but I pretty much ate whatever I want. I remember I was sitting I worked at the Albertsons grocery store at the time, and my buddy Keith and I were working late one night, and the lady from the bakery, Sharon, would, whenever it was like late at night, the bakery was closed, and she was like, either I got to throw this away or you guys got to eat it. So we sat there and we ate like a half sheet ice cream cake. And then we just went home and went to bed. Like, which, you know, most diet gurus would say like, never eat carbs after 6, never, right. You know, all that kind of stuff. So, which I was like the carb king after 6, and I'd wake up from my Saturday morning shift, and I'd always get my buddy Keith, again, we would say we're giving ourselves self-inflicted diabetes, but these donuts are fucking worth it. And the weight was just melting off. Like I wasn't going to the gym at all. And, this weight was just melting off like such a fast degree. I mean, I lost like 40 pounds working out for 4 straight months at 7 days a week and real super regimented, tracking calories, all that kind of stuff. Stopped tracking calories, stopped going to the gym. Did not even really, there was no pressure. I didn't care. And the weight was melting off faster than it was when I was in the gym every day. Mm-hmm. So now I was at this juncture where I was like, 80 pounds down, 85 pounds down. I have the money now. I want to go join like a real gym and like start like muscle building and just, you know, I want to be the superhero. Right.
Right.
So ended up just going to Bally Total Fitness and got a membership and loved going there, but had far more balance. And I think 10 or 15 pounds came off. And that was where I got down to my lowest. So it was 99 pounds of weight loss over the course of about a year.
Yeah.
But again, like that whole, from going from July of 2002 to July of 2003, it was like a completely different guy.
Yeah.
Like I suddenly had confidence. And again, like, even though the weight was the initial issue was the weight I felt, but really, I think I just needed like, I just needed to feel some empowerment, like mm-hmm. get that sense
right.
in, get a little bit more of a swagger, a little bit more right, mojo right. like that. And that was what I got.
Yeah. Well, I think, thank you again for sharing all this. I'm like so fascinated. I forgot I was recording a podcast. Yeah. I think what's cool about this and what's important to me about this anyway is what you're talking about in terms of empowerment, because, you know, a conversation I have probably every day is when we talk about, you could go to the gym from a place of love. You can go to the gym from a place of fear, right? So it's really never about what we're doing. It's about the energy with which we're doing it, the intention, the story, all of those things. And I think sometimes it can feel like a very thin line. And sometimes other people will judge it to be something that it's not, right? But sure. I think I can really also relate and just want to, again, kind of validate that you're not talking about feeling super empowered because you changed your body and then we're getting all of this like praise from other people and then felt a sense of like, oh, now I'm worthy because the other people are telling me that. Yeah. What you're talking about, again, is something I can really personally relate to, which is why this is such an important point to me, is that if you're coming from a place, like you said, where at first there's almost no connection between the body that you're living in and the way that you're feeding it, right? And then all of a sudden you go on this road trip And it's kind of like really in your face, not just in the mirror, but also on the scale. It's like, yeah. Whoa, right? There's an awakening that happens when it's like, wait, something that I'm doing is creating this result, right? Yeah. And that could be anything, right? It's just that for us, it was a body. It was our bodies. So there's an awakening that is, this body is yours, right? You live inside of this body, and how you move it and how you feed it is going to affect what it feels like and what it looks like. So just an awareness that objectively is relatively, you know, harmless and innocent. It's just objective awareness. It's just fact. It's just truth. And then you take that and you say, okay, well, I don't want to look like this and I don't want to feel like this. And being in this body actually isn't really working for me. But what you're talking about when you say power is power. Is I have something to do with this. I can affect this. I can influence this. I can change this. And again, not from a place of fear so that I will be loved and worthy, but from a place of like, I can do something about my life, you know? Yeah. And I think that's such an important distinction, because when we talk about, right, what is healthy? How do we know what is healthy? Well, I think a lot of it is coming from a place of love, not fear. And that's exactly what you're talking about. That is just being able to say, you know, I can do something about this. Wake up and go to the gym and see a result. And of course, you know, like you said, bodybuilding can get super addictive and kind of too extreme and too unhealthy in that way. But to me, I really hear and feel that that's not, you know, that wasn't what that experience was like. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, it wasn't at all. No, it was like, it was being the superhero, but again, because I loved the superhero, not because I was afraid of the villain.
Right. Well said. Very well said. Love that.
So on my left arm, this was done in 2010. But I told this, I was like, okay, like this weight loss is a significant part of my story. And I had the wrong arm. Because there's so many of them.
He's showing me his tattoos.
Yeah. So I don't know how well you can, it's not. So just, there's like a tombstone there. Do you see the tombstone?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I've got this half sleeve on the right side, for those of you that aren't seeing it. And I had walked and I told the tattoo artist, I said, here's the vision that I have. I'm like, think like the elephant graveyard from the Lion King visually, and the date of July 22nd, 2002. And I go, because in a way I feel like that's where this old part of me really died.
Yeah.
This kind of, you know, I don't feel like I'm in control even of my own life or my own destiny or whatever. And so he just did this beautiful tattoo. Mm-hmm. That's like, I mean, it took forever and it hurt like hell, but it's perfect. The questions that I would get, in the subsequent years later, because they see this people, like if I'm wearing like a tank top or something, and then people just see a, you know, a date on it with a, like I have people walk up, they're like, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, what? And, like, and I don't tell the story then, because I'm like, let them, you know, they can make the assumptions. That'll be a good lesson for not making assumptions or whatever. So yeah, that's kind of that's the initial, like, that's where I came to love fitness. And you're right. And it's fast forwarding many, but I'm afraid I'm going to forget to tell this part of the story, but, that's where my love for like fitness came. I hear and observe people, that I've known for years that will tell me like that they can't stick to their exercise program or they can't work out consistently or, whatever. But ultimately it seems like it always inevitably comes down to, did they find something that they actually enjoy? It's like, I see a lot of people that like, I have to go to the gym, but I've always really liked it. Like when I would go, like it felt like a good challenge and I never felt like I was really overtaxing myself.
Yeah.
So it never really came from a place of fear.
Yeah.
Nicole Sacks says it a lot. Like basically we, everything we do as human beings is coming from a place of love or a place of fear.
Yeah.
And there's a great quote by Tupac, when he was in, I think he was in Rikers in New York, and this was in like 1994, 1995. And one of the quotes from an interview that he did then was that, he would always say fear is stronger than love. And I feel like in a lot of ways, like, you can be driven to do some of like the worst stuff to yourself if you're coming from a place of fear.
Yeah.
And subsequently you can do a lot of great things to yourself coming from a place of love. But he would always say that to him in his life, fear is stronger than love, because he said that regardless of all the love he would give out, he never got anything in return but fear. You know, like that's very much like a living in scarcity sort of thing. But the times when I can recall doing something out of fear typically will come when I'm prepping for a competition, like a weightlifting competition. And if you recall, about 2 months ago or 7 weeks ago or so, you were on the podcast, my podcast, and we were talking about, I told you that I felt like my window to be able to compete on a national level was dwindling. And I was like, you know, I've got 3 or 4 pounds to lose and then I could qualify. But I only have a few weeks before the qualifying window will be closed. And you and I, you know, we were just kind of talking about that. Well, shit you not. So I go and I, we got off that call and within a couple of days, I downloaded MyFitnessPal. I started working on far more mobility because I was like, I've got to be able to get in better positions to be able to achieve this and do all that. Like, that doesn't sound like a voice of love. That sounds like a voice of fear. And I had my, by far my worst relapse of pain that I've had this whole TMS time, which has been 5 years now at this point, where my lower back locked up and it was just spasm after spasm. And it went that way for about a month. And I, you know, there was sort of like the perfect storm at that time. There was other stuff going on in life at the time, but I just think about the language that I was using internally around that time, which was, I've only got a few weeks. I've got to get this done. I've got to do this. I feel like any of the got to's or have to's or any of that, that's again, that's the difference in like when I was a teenager and wanting to lose weight of I've got to go to the gym 7 days a week to get this done versus my body's pretty tired. I'm going to eat this ice cream cake and I lost the same amount of weight.
Right, right.
So what's the difference?
I thank you so much for sharing all of this. I couldn't be nodding any harder. I totally hear you. And I think what's really cool actually too, this is a story I've never shared because, well, I never actually did the thing, but I remember a friend of mine telling me years ago that someone he knew, after a tremendous amount of weight loss, tattooed on his back his highest weight ever. And the whole kind of story was that it's behind me. That's part of, you know, kind of very similar to what you're saying. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I loved that idea at the time. And I remember being like, you know, I would love to have 302 on my back because it's behind me. And then part of the reason I think this is important to just kind of speak to is then I went through a period of time, right? Definitely influenced by the very, you know, we talked about this on your podcast, the very kind of anti-diet movement, right? That was, I don't want to define myself by my body. I don't want to define myself by a number. It's not about the number. I don't want that on my body. Like all of those things. But again, there's part of me that just feels super validated in sharing this between us. That is, it is absolutely behind me. The same way that anyone who is, you know, a recovering alcoholic, it is behind them. It is a different, it was a different life. And again, what I think you and I have in common is that it was the weight and the body that woke us up. It was it was an awareness. It was a coming back home into the body, tapping into a sense of power that we just didn't know we had and we weren't aware of, you know? So I just want to clarify, you know, for anyone who's like hearing this and kind of like cringing, you know, that it's like, oh, it feels fear-based. Well, that's a judgment, right? Because you and I know what it has been like to be in that kind of, not just that kind of body, but in that kind of relationship to our body. And really ultimately in a lot of ways, dissociative for the first part of life, and then waking up and actually taking ownership and tapping into power. And that's why it feels important that, you know, it is behind us. I don't think there is any going back once you're awake to it. And that's really super powerful. And I really hear you.
I was, one of the things I shared with my therapist lately was I was talking about how this was a previous therapist had told me that when we kind of did the first few sessions of like, you know, I'm talking about my childhood and what, like, and for me, there was sort of a big theme of like, of the bullying and the teasing over the weight stuff. And one thing that he would always tell me is basically like in times of toughness in life or, you know, you're facing brick walls, things like that. The thing he would always say is, what I want you to do is just visualize you as an adult now and all the things that you've achieved and all the things that you've done and that you've got this nice house and these two girls and all this kind of stuff. And that you're just putting your arm around that overweight kid that was being made fun of as a child, you know, put yourself back in that place. It's like, it's a really stark difference.
Yeah.
between the two. And it's interesting. I was telling the new therapist this, because my past one had retired, but I was telling him about this, and he was asking me, well, like, what are some of the times where you felt like you, because I started to say, like, you know, body dysmorphia for men, it's not really talked about, but like it really exists.
Yeah.
It's not talked about that much anyway, but it really exists. And I was like, let me give you an example that I'd say physically, if you would have looked at me in 2012, 2013, I was by far and away in the best shape physically.
Yeah.
Like when I go back and I look at pictures now, and I had like a 5.5 pack. And like my, like I was pretty, I think I was like 9.5% body fat or 10% body fat. Like I was, it was very, yeah. I was doing CrossFit every day. I was very hard on myself and all that kind of stuff. But I remember at the time when I would see myself in the mirror, I could literally point out, I would say like, that part of my pec is fat, that part of my, like, so it right. didn't, I look back now and I say like, damn, like you were in like phenomenal shape. Right. So it's just, you know, it's interesting. Like I didn't feel all that powerful at that point in time, even though I physically looked just fine. So it, I mean, I don't even know what, what the point of that was, but, it's just kind of an always evolution of thought when it comes yes. to this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's important. I had, Jeff was a very early podcast, but he was one of my group members, and he's also a coach and a therapist. And after doing our work together, he was saying it is so important to specifically be bringing this to men, because mm-hmm. it is something that is absolutely not talked about enough in that community. So you are so not alone. And I just yeah. appreciate, you know, the shout out to that yeah. and validating that and normalizing that, because yeah. it really is so true. Okay. So, you know, where did we leave off? then, I mean, my question is then what?
I guess, so I think the last part of like the chronological piece was, losing all the weight that I wanted to lose.
Yeah.
Looking the way pretty much that I wanted to look. And by that point in time, I was a late teen, early 20s, that kind of thing. But as the years have rolled on, like I have noticed that like the rhetoric to me, like when people talk to me, you know, they make assumptive comments that I eat super good all the time, that I exercise a lot, that all this kind of stuff. So I'm like, that's a whole different persona from when I was like a mid teen.
Right.
I saw myself as a overweight person. I would get jokes about going to fast food restaurants from people and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And now like my diet is not the best it can be. But like, that's okay. So that's kind of like the ultimate victory wasn't looking like Thor or looking like Triple H or looking like, or whatever, but it was more so like being able to feel
yes.
that there was some power and gain that.
Right.
And I think that's really sort of like the best gift that there,
right.
you know, that, like that there could be, I mean, being right. able to exude that kind of confidence more so with myself, nobody has to be around, but it's right. just getting that feeling that I don't have, you know, that I'm not.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think what's cool about listening to that, I mean, I've very much experienced, you know, a lot of the same thing. I remember when I was a personal trainer at the gym and everyone was like, so you eat lettuce all day. And I was like, what? No. Yeah. But I think, you know, what I hear when I listen to that is that what you're talking about now is there's power and there's freedom.
Yeah.
You know, whereas before when you're counting all the points or like tracking every single thing, you might feel empowered, but there's no freedom.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about now is that you get to be in both of those places, which again is really the greatest gift, which is really what we're all going for. And again, if we bring it back to safety, because we know that that's really important to work with the mind-body system, when you're in a place of freedom, it feels safe. Mm-hmm. Right? When you feel like you don't have freedom, it doesn't feel safe. And then Weight Watchers is the saber-tooth tiger or whatever else is the saber-tooth yeah. tiger, but that's really it.
Yeah.
So amazing.
Yeah. That period of time, like 6 weeks ago or 7 weeks ago that I was talking about where, I had the scale back out, my Fitness Pal was downloaded, which has since been deleted. Every time I go back to like, like I'll do it every couple of years where I'll like re-download the app. I'll go to ifitfitsyourmacros.com.
Right.
I'll calculate all that out. I'm like, well, that's way more calories than I thought you were going to tell me I was going to get.
Yeah.
but still just the act of going through and even getting to, because it's weird. It's like I get towards the end of the day and I would have 500 or 600 calories left or whatever. And then just like throwing everything down, like having three bowls of cereal instead of my usual one.
Right.
So it's just kind of having this, I had this epiphany the other night. And it was really amazing because my back was still killing me as of recently as last Friday night. And then I was sitting at the baseball game, I was at the Mariners Astros game. And I just kind of had this epiphany, like you're trying to control all these things, like the food scale and the MyFitnessPal and the your kids' feelings and the pandemic and the work and what your clients think of you and all this kind of stuff. And then I'm like, and you really don't have a lot of control over any of that. Mm-hmm. And it was just like this, just like, I just felt like 500 pound weight had been taken off of my shoulders. Yeah. And it was just really nice to have that feeling that basically anytime that I try to really control something, like the way that I tried to control all that weight to initially come off, I get stuck, and that's just how it is.
Totally hear you. And I think, I mean, this is something I've been talking more about and thinking more about myself, is that there is, again, it's like a thin line and it feels like a subtle difference, but psychologically and energetically, there is a big difference between, I think, power and control. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's something really, I use the word healthy for lack of a better word. There's something really healthy about feeling empowered and a sense of power. Yeah. But then it's a very different conversation in the mind body system to be thinking about control, because again, we don't have total control. We don't actually have very much control at all, but we can tap into where we have power. And that feels very different, you know? So I think, again, it goes back to like love and fear, abundance and scarcity. And it makes all the sense in the world, everything you're saying. And thank you for sharing that.
You know, it's related to food, but it's not about a human. It's about my dog. But I remember one of the things that this only came up because you said the word scarcity, and I know I used it earlier.
Yeah.
But we have a black lab that's out of her mind. She's 2 years old. She's the love of my life, actually. I slipped up and I called her babe a couple of weeks ago. My wife heard it. She was like, did you just call the dog babe? And then she asked our 7-year-old to come in, Zoe. And she's like, Zoe, who should dad call babe in the house? And she was like, well, you and me and Audrey. And Jenny was like, what about Lucy? And she's like, a dog? And I'm like, you know. Yes, she's my babe.
I see you there. My cat is asleep on my lap right now.
So one thing that the vet told me on Lucy's very first appointment was like, dogs and labs, and especially labs, but they sort of have this rep of like, you pour the food in the bowl and they just like, you know, they scrounge it. They can't get enough. Like they'll slam it all down their throat and there's nothing else. So one thing that he told me was like, feed her like 3 big meals a day and do that for a while, and she will never have food issues because there's not scarcity around it. He's like, having a weird relationship with food for dogs is like, it's really unhealthy because they will always retain that. Right. So we've done that, and now she's like a cow that just sort of grazes throughout the day.
Yeah,
couple kibbles, goes for a walk, couple kibbles, plays fetch, couple kibbles. And I'm like, gosh, like, how could you apply that into humans? Because it's perfect.
Yeah.
What Dr. Thrum said.
It's absolutely true. And I think about, I mean, part of the reason I like laugh when you say it's not about a human, it's about a dog, is partially because it's like, those are the best examples because they're not, there's no like judgment and like guilt. It just like is what it is. Right. And I had a cat a long time ago that was basically like on the street, starved. And when we first took it in, it was basically emaciated. Yeah. And then over the next, you know, months, year, whatever, it was the fattest cat you could find, because that's just how it goes, right? If we're coming from scarcity, it feels like a famine to the brain. Yep. The brain's going to try to protect us. It's going to gain all this weight. And then what I thought was really cool too, was the next couple of years, just watching the weight come off again. And watching her kind of stabilize, because it's kind of that way. That is like, when there's regular food and there's access to food and we're not living in scarcity, either physically or mentally, emotionally, we just get to a place of stabilization, which it sounds like your dog has as well.
Yeah. And actually, as a human personally, I'm sort of there too. Like it seems like it doesn't really matter what I do, what I eat, whatever, like,
right.
I just sort of stay the same.
Yeah.
And for me, it's entirely about performance. That's one other thing that that has been an important part of this entire story is that I told you that like 2012, 2013, like physically I was if you looked at me, you'd be like, man, like that guy's in really great shape. But I wasn't really performing all that well. I like ran a half marathon and I could do cardio workouts until the cows come home and I wouldn't break, you know, I wouldn't be breathing hard. Like a half marathon, I smoked it. I'd never ran more than 10 miles in my life. And I did a half marathon in an hour and 43 minutes, which for like half marathon gurus that I know, they say that's like a smoking ass time.
Yeah.
I've never done one again since then. And I don't have a desire to do one ever again, but I did it. And I came across this book by a guy named, I think his name was D.H. Kiefer, but the book was called, at that time I was having no carbs. It was a no carb diet. It was a high protein, moderate fat, no carb diet. And then he had written this book about performance and carbs necessity for performance. And it kind of blew my mind a little bit.
Yeah.
And his whole mantra was around, depending on what time of the day you worked out, let's say you worked out in the morning or the afternoon, that you backload all of your carbs to the evening. So you have them all basically like between 5 p.m. in bed. And then the idea is that it's fueling you heavily for the next day. Mm-hmm. And so I found this service called Eat to Perform. They're a great business and consulted for them for years. But they had a lot of the same idea. They made some tweaks and amounts of stuff that you would be eating. But I went with them and I put on 15 or 20 pounds over it was like a 4 month space, but my calories had gone from like 1200 a day to like 3000 a day. So it's like, I gained weight, but like, I looked like a superhero compared to what I looked like before.
Yeah.
And my performance gains were going through the roof.
Yes.
And suddenly now like the North Star was all about performance, whereas it had always been 100% about what did I weigh?
Right.
So, and really like my measuring stick has been that ever since.
Yeah.
Because the story was so impressive to them, like they asked me to come on and consult. And so I would work with some of their clients. And one of the interesting things that I would find is like, they would kind of stick me with people that not stick me with people, but they align me with people, clients that like, were just having, they felt a little stuck. Like they just kind of, they weren't getting past whatever, you know, whatever block they were at. And the theme that I always would come to with them when I would tell them, like, describe your life, describe how you do this, describe like, what are the end goals in line? What are you doing right now? What are the sort of the shorter goals and all this kind of stuff? And it was like every single time it was these people like high stress, high, got to do this, need to do this. And this didn't come to me until years later with the Sarno stuff. But I would tell them like, hey, like any way that you can necessitate a level of stress reduction. And that could just entirely just mean like not putting so much pressure on whatever we think this long-term goal is. So like, how about instead of 6 days a week working out, you go to 5 or we go to 4, we even go to 3.
Yeah.
I'm like, let's do that for like 3 months. And, and I'll, you know, I would assign their macros and tell them what to do and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the amount of food that they would have would go up. Their amount of workouts per week went down, but their performance shot through the roof.
Yes.
Some of the hardest part then just would become wrangling them in from like, hey, I know that you've always used this term active recovery day. And that has always involved you going to the CrossFit gym and doing rowing sprints for an hour. And for some reason, somehow that's recovery. Right. I'm like, but why don't you just like go walk your dog or like go to the batting cage and hit some baseballs for a few hours or go to the driving range and hit a golf ball or whatever, like take some actual active recovery.
Yeah.
And that's like, that had miraculous results with people to them. And I think now like looking back, like so much of that was probably taking the edge off.
Yep.
Like when you could remove that must, you know, all like, I don't know. I know that for me, I've always performed the best when I have no pressure end goal. I don't give a shit. Whatever happens, happens. Like, you know, it's fun. Like whatever happens is fine.
Right.
And I've talked about this in the podcast too. Like that's the way that I perform the best, whether I'm riding my one wheel or I'm riding one of my motorcycles or I did this gnarly 2000 mile solo trip last summer on my motorcycle. And I'd be in like the most remote parts of Oregon or Northern California. I have no cell service, which is pretty dumb. Like when you think about it, being on a big motorcycle and if it falls over and you break your leg and there's no service and you're 20 miles from a main road. Like, it's just a bad idea in the wilderness and a fucking bear comes up, like, whatever. When I was having that attitude of like, whatever happens, happens, like, it'll be fine. It'll be good. Like, nothing bad ever happened. And my performance was always through the roof. So I don't know. That's just the theme that I've captured.
It's super important. And I appreciate you saying all of those things. And I hope everyone is listening to this part, because this is the part that is really juicy and important in terms of integration. Like, oh, okay, you know, all of this in theory, like, your story is fascinating. And also, how do we take, you know, what are some things that we can actually, like, use in our everyday life? And I think what's important is many things, but one is, this is true for humans in general, not just athletes, right? And not just, you know, your quote unquote performance is also just like your quality of life and energy, right? So if you're not performing, or you're not competing, and you don't consider yourself an athlete, all of these things, all of these principles still apply, because you're a human being in a mind body system. And that much is true. And what you're saying, you know, in Nicole Sachs's version of this would be, however it goes, it's okay for me. Right. And coming back to the mentality, but the mentality is important because it creates the energy that is, no matter what happens, you are safe. And again, if we have to work with the mind body, the primitive animal brain, what we have to do is always have and come from that element of safety. And it feels so, you know, minor. But the truth is that it really, exactly, this is why, right, everyone who's listening to this is why, when you're working with people, consulting one-on-one, people want to lose weight, people want to lose fat, people want to change their body, whatever it is, what you're saying is the biggest results, hear this, come from taking the edge off, taking some of the pressure off, and just maybe actually working out a little bit less and eating a little bit more. And what happens? How do we move forward in a way that is different when we're coming from the energy of whatever happens, happens, you know? Yeah. Because very often, especially when it comes to weight loss, especially if you have a history of being overweight or obese, there is the energy is that, if you know, weight loss is safety and not weight loss is danger. And everything is riding on it, and the charge is so strong. And it's just, that's the part that actually needs to change. And what we're saying here is coming from a place, rather than fear, of love. And it's huge. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Yeah, it certainly is the mother load. I mean, like, as recently as January, my youngest daughter brought COVID into the house. And I remember up to this point, I had said, like, my thoughts on how I would eventually handle COVID entering the house changed probably in November or so, because I kind of got to a point where I was like, whatever happens, just like what we just said, whatever happens, happens. And if I die, you know, I had a good run. Like, you know, it is what it is. My youngest daughter brings it in the house. My oldest daughter catches it. I'm still snuggling with them on the couch. It just, you know, it's whatever. Even though, like, my mom and, like, the health department, when they called us and said, like, your daughter's tested positive, here's what they're like, you need to be wearing a mask, you need to be separating, you need to be doing all this. And I'm like, we're watching Snow White, I'm holding them, it's not a big deal. My wife got it, and she had a hell of a time. And guess who the only person in the house that didn't get it was? I was sleeping in the same bed, I was taking care of all, and I was just, but I just kept saying, like, I was literally, it wasn't just me saying this, right. I literally felt, right, if I catch this and I die, there's nothing I can do about it. So it is what it is. And I never caught it. Yeah. And I've told the story a lot on this, but the only other, the best example I have, I think, other than eating ice cream cake and losing 40 pounds by eating, like, you know, not really giving a shit, was I used to be horribly afraid of airplanes. Just the taxing, the takeoff, the engine, the landing, any turbulence, like, my heart was just, and it was really bad, like, big airlines, little airplanes, like, whatever, didn't even matter. We were up in the air. I just always felt like, we're going to crash, I'm going to die. We're going to crash, I'm going to die. And I would say that over and over and over in my head. And then I was on this plane in 2010 going to Dallas, and there was an ice storm, and we were starting to have the turbulence. Like, we'd just drop 10 feet suddenly, and then it would go back up. And people are, you can audibly hear them yelling, and I remember I I'm starting to have sweaty palms. Like my heart was starting to race. And I had this moment where I just kind of looked inward and it was like an outer body experience. And I just said, if this plane goes down and crashes, like I can't stop the plane. Right. So like, right. We're here, you know, we're having a good time or whatever.
Yeah.
And I tell you, my palms immediately dried up. My heart rate dropped down to 50.
Yeah.
And I've never had a fear of airplanes ever since. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter the size, nothing. Mm-hmm. And it was just literally like nothing changed about the airplane. We still had turbulence until we landed.
Yeah.
But it was just how I just interpreted this all of a sudden as like, you know, whatever, like whatever. It's right. Fine.
It's kind of funny you say that. Thank you for sharing that story. I feel that deeply, but it's actually kind of funny you say that. Cause I was just telling a friend of mine how, and I think this is a result of like doing all of this work and, you know, just following kind of the thread into the spiritual journey that is, you know, awakening to all of this. But, I had a very, very, very like almost exact same story where recently, and I can't say I was always like afraid of planes, but you know, turbulence is scary, especially like it's out of nowhere. And I was on this plane and the same exact thing. It just kind of starts getting bumpy. People are like, shaking, kind of freaking out. And again, it was almost like you said, an out of body experience. It was not a conscious thought. I was actually just telling Nicole Sachs this at our retreat over the weekend. And I was saying, like, I was sitting on the airplane and it was just this awareness that washed over me, exactly like what you're saying. That is, you know, if this is it, this is it.
Yeah.
But what, you know, like, okay. And it's exactly like what you were just saying though before, right? Of when you have this awareness of like, I'm trying to control this and this and this and this and this and this. And actually, I don't really have control over any of that stuff. Yeah. And just that like exhale of like, okay, yeah. Okay. You know, I'm here for the ride, wherever it's going to take me. And I think, you know, as the friend I was telling this to, he looked at me and he said, that is some advanced shit, because it feels inaccessible sometimes to be at that place of peace. But really I think part of the reason it's so interesting to kind of go that, to get to that depth of existentialism right now is because it actually has everything to do with our relationship with food and eating and our bodies. And a lot of what we try to do, right, is sit on the airplane and just like contract our body enough that the turbulence stops. And what you and I know is that you can contract your body all you want, but the turbulence is not necessarily going to stop.
Yep.
And if it does, it has nothing to do with how much you're contracting your body. Yep. So what we can do for ourselves is say, all right, mm-hmm. where do I not have any control?
Yeah.
And then also the difference, right, when it comes to food and eating in our bodies is where do I have some power? And existing in that place where it's not about, you know, landing the plane yourself. It's just about like, how do I make it a little bit more peaceful while I'm here?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Incredible. Okay. So I know for the sake of time, I think the, you know, kind of toward wrapping, what I'm curious to ask you is when it comes to being in a place of, it sounds like balance. Ultimately, it's like, you know, you're mindful of what you're eating. You know how to move your body. That's still important to you. Health matters. Can you speak a little bit to just kind of like establishing a relationship with food and eating in your body that is coming from a place of love, mindfulness, you're staying connected, right? You're not doing that thing where it's like, yeah, fuck it, whatever. I'll just eat whatever I want, right? Yeah. How do you, this is my question, how do you maintain a mentality, an energy of love, abundance, wellness, mindfulness, connection, alignment, rather than it kind of going from one side of the pendulum, you know, super restrictive, rigid, or the other side of the spectrum, right? That is just like kind of fuck it, whatever mentality.
So I think it depends on the audience. If you have a professional athlete who is paid to do a sport that is listening, this is not going to apply.
100%. Thank you for saying that.
But I think for the other 99.9 or perhaps 100% of people, that where I arrived at that, what you're talking about, was essentially when I came to the realization that, first, I think it begins in activity, because like Steve Ozanich for TMS stuff says that really like the heart and soul of being able to kind of be at one with yourself is the arts. And he describes that as making music or painting or doing podcasts or making videos or like whatever.
Yeah.
So for me, in that vein, it's very much finding something athletic, which literally could just be you really like walking.
Yep.
But like you got to really enjoy whatever it is. And then when it comes to the food part, to me, I always think that it's for fueling for performance, whatever that, whatever performing in whatever sport it is that you want. So like for me, it's like weightlifting and CrossFit are the things that I really enjoy. That's like high carb burning. Like that's the, you know, that's sort of the, so I have a lot of carbs. Whereas like carbs are demonized in a lot of other facets. And there's really no excuse for that. Just no good excuse for that, that yeah. I can, it is a quick way to be able to lose weight because there is water retention exists. And, but like, you know, yeah. a UFC fighter can drop 40 pounds in 2 days doing
right,
water.
Right.
So it's like, does it really even matter? Are they 40 pounds lighter or did they just do something to manipulate temporarily? And that's really what like depleting carbs is for most well people. Said.
Yes.
So for me, it just all comes back down to fueling for the performance of whatever it is that you want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if you're somebody that really likes sprinting, if you're somebody that really likes running, if you're somebody like all these things need fuel. And if you can think about it as being that way, and if you ever find yourself hungry, that's a problem. And if you find yourself feeling like you gorged, that's also a problem. But it's just really being able to be in tune with like, and again, I just think the most sustainable way is performance based, and that breaks are okay. And other things are good in moderation. Like every Wednesday, I love making dinner and a Moscow mule with my wife. And like, I love doing that.
Yeah.
And for right around, actually, ironically, right around this time when I had the relapse and I had the, you know, not, I was counting the calories, I was doing all that. But I also had said like no more alcohol for a while. Cause you had said,
I remember
you,
that
you were talking about
I know.
It. So I was like, I had made the joke. You're telling me I can't have my meals on Wednesdays. And you said, I'm not saying that. But then we hung up the phone. I was like, fuck, I should cut that out because I want to, and who knows, the perfect storm of all these things yeah. in life in a time when I probably needed to take the edge off and I was adding a lot of edge on. Yes. And it was like riding on a razor blade for a couple of weeks. You know, it didn't do me any favors. My system couldn't handle all that. And it wigged out. So for me, it's always fueling to the appropriate performance and remembering that the bad stuff in moderation is, I think it's perfect. I have a dessert. My mom says it doesn't count as dessert because it's not like a cake or like it's finding a treat that you enjoy it. My grandfather-in-law, who was one of the most famous neurosurgeons in all of Seattle, he would run miles every single night, like very active before he passed. But he would always tell my wife, like, dessert is the priority because like it's the little treat that he wanted. A little bit of ice cream, a little bit right. of this, whatever. I have a bowl of shitty cereal every single night because it's like, like you know, I'm here. Like I love Frosted Mini Wheats and Cinnamon Chex and whatever. And then the kids like take my chocolate Chex. I'm like, you stay off my chocolate Chex. And Jenny's like, why do you think they eat your favorite cereals? And I was like, because there's like a cartoon character on the front. Like I know why they do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. That balance is fine. I think the life and death stuff. I think it just like it's incredible. I did a podcast a few years ago where I had said how hard it was to injure yourself, like really injure yourself where you're taken out of your sport. And it was just speaking to the resilience of the body.
Yeah.
And I think this stuff is a lot of the same way, like a lot of eating and a lot of over calorie consumption over a really extended period of time, you're going to gain weight. However, moderation a couple times a week, a few times a week, whatever, it's not going to kill you. And again, just anything you can do to really authentically take the edge off, I think is beneficial.
Amazing. Really well said. And I think, you know, if I were to like spark notes it, it's what you're saying is, you know, have some mindfulness around what you're eating. Sure. Yeah. Allow yourself to have what you want and ultimately take the edge off and make sure that you're feeling safe. Yeah. And it's, I feel the way it's so embodied that it's just kind of like, that's your norm now. Yeah. And I think it's just really important for everyone who's listening. That is, you know, the most important thing here is knowing that this is, it's actually not life or death when it comes to what you're putting in your mouth or what the scale says today, right now.
Yeah.
And when you can relate to it in that way, everything starts to shift. And ironically, right, this is the paradoxical theory of change. This is something I teach in my curriculum that is, as soon as we kind of release the attachment to the outcome, we get the outcome we were attached to. And it's everything.
Yeah. When my boss texts me and tells me to start making a whole bunch of extra cold calls to potential clients, and I'll do that for 8 hours a day, not one person will pick up the phone. And then the morning I wake up and like, I'm getting emails from people I haven't talked to in a year that say, hey, like, we're ready to, like, what did I just spend the whole year? I could have done something else, you know? So no, yeah. I totally find that that's how the competitions that I've performed at by far the best. It wasn't the last. It wasn't even close to the most recent one, but the first competition where I really like lifted like a good amount of weight that I was like, really felt like if you would have asked me a year prior to that, here's the total that you'll be lifting at in a year, I'd have been like, fuck, there's no way.
Yeah.
I was, but I remember going into the competition and being like, okay, these are the numbers on it. Like, two, you know, I'll hit it. I just want to have fun. Like, that's all I really care about. I don't give a shit about the income, about the outcome. And I went 6 for 6 and I killed it. And like, I look back on that so fondly because it was a stark contrast. I did a competition in 2017 when I had come back from having my shoulder rebuilt. And I had said, I just kept telling myself, like, you did all this rehab to come back and have this moment. And like, this is what you need to achieve. And I didn't do anywhere close to what I should have done or could have done. I think if I would have just said, like, look, man, like, you gotta be proud of yourself. You did 6 months of rehab every single day.
Right.
To get back and even have a shot to do this, and you'll be fine.
Right.
I bet I would have performed much better doing that. Yeah. And I always do one, I'll get out of here after this, but I do just a 1 mile run. It's not a sprint, but like, I just do a 1 mile run as my last thing that I'm going to do, like as a workout for the week. Mm-hmm. And I always post my result on Instagram stories, and I always get quick, 'cause I'll put what it was last week versus what I just did. And I always get these messages like, you know, what's your goal or whatever. And I'm like, just, you know, better than last week. We'll just say better than last week. 'Cause I don't have this hard edge, like it is what it is. And if I don't, then I don't, and that's fine. And this past week, 'cause again, this was when I had the realization sitting at the baseball game. Normally it's been 1 second faster, five seconds faster, whatever. But then I had this realization at the baseball game about control. And I did my run, and it was like a 41 seconds off. And I wasn't like, I was trying, but I wasn't racing.
Yeah.
And it was just so different to look down and see the watch and be like, holy shit. Like, that was pretty good. So
it's so cool.
Yeah. Like, the harder you don't try, the better it gets, which is really like, it's very, I don't know. It's very tough to like be in a job like sales, or like, you know, they want forecasts of what's going to happen in a week or a month, a year or whatever. And I'm like, it'll work out. Just tell your boss, like you want your projection, like just instead of a number, just type like, it'll be fine.
Right. And it's so funny because it's the exact same thing when it comes to something like our bodies and then, you know, the number on the scale where it's like, okay, well, what's going to be now? What's going to be the week after? What's going to be and it's like, just know that it's going to be fine and like relax a little bit. And again, all of this is such a great illustration of ultimately, at the end of the day, we are a mind, body, soul system.
Yeah.
We can try and act like we're just bodies and control our way there. But when we create the energy that allows us to just exist in safety and freedom and power, it is what it needs to be. Yeah. And it's just, I so hear you. And I've had so many of those experiences myself. All I could do is like nod feverishly at you. So Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Is there anything else? I know we could literally talk forever. Is there anything else just in wrapping that you want to kind of share or highlight or whatever, anything?
No. I mean, to be honest, I got nothing else. Awesome. I guess, well, I said, find a sport that you like, find a hobby that you really like too. I think, you know, stuff like that is really important. When my life was the most small when I was, again, like forcing on goals and all that kind of stuff. But it's, I've got a lot of different things that I do now and nothing with a particular goal. I ride the skateboard, I ride the one wheel, I ride the motorcycle. I just want to have I'm just here for a good time.
Hell yeah. That is an important last point. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us again where we can find you if we are interested.
Yeah. So it's the Mind and Fitness Podcast. And it's on all major podcasts. I haven't found one that it's not on. So let's just say Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and sometimes drops Wednesday, sometimes drops Thursday, sometimes drops Friday. I used to always put it on Wednesday, and then it was just kind of like, sometimes I just run out of time. And so it'll be a day or two later and it's fine. But it, with rare exceptions, it's there every week.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here. I look forward to doing this again sometime.
Yeah. Thanks, Lisa.
Of course.